Today we're starting a new class on Hebrews. Like I did Philippians, I put together a little PowerPoint presentation for you guys, because I know how much you love PowerPoint. This is basically going to follow the same format that we did with Philippians. It's going to talk about the various things on the background that come with the book, such as author, title, timeline, literary themes, that kind of thing, just to help you get a better understanding of the book once we actually start to read it, which will probably end up starting next week. So, after I turn this on, author, who wrote the book of Hebrews? Anybody know?
Paul.
That's a guess. Well, a lot of people do think Paul wrote it. There's certainly some... There is a few literary styles that suggest that Paul wrote this book, but we don't know. The biggest difference is Paul is normally one who signs his letters, and if he did write this book, for some reason he did not sign it. While it has some themes that are common with Paul, it doesn't really fit his writing style, and so more and more recently people reject Paul as an author. A lot of people have been suggested, such as Barnabas, Clement, Luke, I had Barnabas twice for some reason, Apollos. I even heard someone suggest that Phoebe wrote this book. But frankly, we just don't know. Origen, who is a very early church father, or often called a church father, he lived about 254 BC, and he has a quote on the author of this book, which is basically, who actually wrote the epistle? Only God knows.
At this
Okay. Yeah. I don't think there's anywhere in here that it identifies. Does it have that in a footnote? Yeah. A lot of people, Paul has the most support, but we really just don't know. Yeah. There is... Oh, I can't remember his name. One of the early church fathers who lived about 150 B.C., AD. He said that the church by the 2nd century was using the 4 Gospels and the 10 letters of Paul. If you count the 10 letters of Paul, Hebrews is not included in that letter. So at least by 150 A.D., they were not recognizing Hebrews as a letter of Paul. So that's one of the support against it. But that's just a little bit about the author. There's not really much more I can say about that. Like I said, most people think Paul, but we really honestly don't know who wrote it. Audience. So this is what we know about the audience. Who was Hebrew written to? Well, probably the Jews, like James. What we do know about the audience, especially in relation to the author, is the author knows the audience personally. He's not writing from afar, or he might be writing from afar, but we know at least at some point he probably started this church. There's some references to he longs to be reunited from them in chapter 13. It says he's a mutual friend of Timothy. This is probably the same Timothy of Paul, which also a lot of people think this might be Paul. But this is where we think it's not Paul, because he said, attested to us by those who heard. So this quote kind of gives you the idea that he has not seen Jesus. And we know that Paul has seen Jesus on the road to Damascus, as outlined in Acts chapter 9. Date. This book was written probably around 65 A.D. There is no precise dating like with most of the books. A lot of this is just guesswork. A educated guesswork. A lot of people think it's before 70 A.D. Let me give you a mini test. Who can tell me what significant event happened in 70 A.D.? I'm going to go with George. Yeah. Well, specifically, the city was destroyed, but it's, the temple itself was destroyed as well. Now, why would this indicate this book was written before the temple was destroyed? If anybody's familiar with Hebrews. Yes, exactly. Hebrews talks a lot about the sacrificial system that was done in the temple. Now, back all the way to Solomon, King Solomon. Solomon built the first temple. And when he built the first temple, what they did was they centralized worship. As they pretty much said, all the sacrificial stuff had to happen in Jerusalem. And that basically took place for the next 700, 800, 900 years. Except for the brief periods that the temple was destroyed between there. And so, when he's talking about the context of the sacrificial system, he gives the impression that this is still happening. And so, a lot of people believe that because of the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, this has to be written before that event takes place. Okay. Overarching theme. What's the book about? Christ is greater than any angel, priest, or Old Testament institution. Thus, each reader, rather than leaving such a great salvation, is summoned to hold on by faith to the true rest found in Christ and to encourage others in the church to persevere. So, purpose of the book. This is another reason Hebrews is a good title for this book, is because a lot of this book talks about that old system. The priests, the sacrificial system, the Old Testament, and the basic lesson in here is Christ is greater, and you don't need to return to that because He is greater. I think we can even apply this as a more broad statement. He's probably greater. He is greater than everything else in your life, or any other institution in your life. But here, there's the danger of returning. The author is talking about them. Sorry, I'm getting tongue-tied here. I'm going to back up a little bit. So, a lot of people at this time were probably returning back to Judaism. They've been in Christianity for, we don't really know, and for some reason they found that they either didn't want to follow it, or it wasn't working for them, or whatever. Go ahead, Mark. Sure. I think that we can kind of get into that too when we move into legalism. I think your point is valid, but I also think it might be a little bit more basic than that. I think what's probably happened is they're finding it too hard, and they would rather move back to something they know, even if it's not physically helpful. And I think a good example of this is looking at them in the desert, the Jews in the desert after leaving Egypt. How many times does it say they want to go back to slavery because they found that as a preferable option than being free in the middle of a desert? So I think some of that same thing is happening here. Though probably a lot is happening to what you're referring to as well.
I could also see, like, by faith, you might need to kind of like start to doubt or like, you know.
Yeah, actually, that makes a lot of sense too. Maybe kind of like if you look at the parable of the sower, those are the people who are quick to respond but quick to fall away. George, and then I'll come back to you. Mm-hmm. Oh, heaven forbid, huh? I think we could probably guess a lot of this. Like, maybe some people joined because they thought it would be the next big thing. I don't know. I mean, we see church attendance fluctuate a lot. And some people leave because, you know, they move. Probably not as common there. Yeah, but it's a lot easier to go back to what you know. Go ahead, Buckley.
What scripture are we using to...
This is just an overall... This is just a very basic summary of the book. Oh, yeah, we'll get to that in a second. I'll come back to you. Okay.
Part of the reason why I would agree with what you're saying there is that Jesus died right around 33 AD. We're talking about something that was written probably before 70 AD.
Mm-hmm.
That time period is relatively short.
Yes.
That time period is relatively short. Lifespan, we're relatively short compared to today. And so I think the possibility exists that what you're saying is true. That some of the folks might have been heading back that direction because it's easier. And, you know, you can look at this book and say that they were addressing things because they were surrounded by Judaism on all sides. And, you know, the church was really strong and there was no confusion. But that's not really the picture you get from this book. It seems to me, from the picture of this book, in the context, like Buckley was asking for, in the context, that there was some confusion. And that the author was trying to set it straight and making sure they were and drawing them back.
Yeah.
The original process is in salvation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's precedent for that too. And that's basically what the Council of Galatia is about. And that's Galatians chapter 2, as what should you do as a Christian and what should you do as a Jew. In that case, you have to separate them because Judaism is it's a people and it's a religion. Okay. Purpose, occasion, and background. Genre. Is it a letter or is it a sermon? A lot of people identify it as both. It's very unusual for a letter. It doesn't have an introduction. It just kind of it starts off like you might even start off a sermon. But it does have greetings and blessings. It even says it is written to you, like you might see it written in a letter. But it's more probably like a sermon because it has a rhetorical progression, frequently practical exhortations, and identifies his work as an exhortation, kind of like you might find in a sermon. It's also probably... I jumped ahead. It encourages the audience to endure their faith. Faith is a very big theme of this book, especially about what we were just talking about, going back to having your faith and going back to that faith in Judaism. It warns against leaving Christ, which is kind of what I think Buckley was asking about. I'm going to show that here in a second in the outline. Basically, that Christ is superior, greater than the angels, Moses, the tabernacle, the priesthood, and the sacrificial system. Background, the audience needs to continue enduring through persecution and trials of life. Grow less attentive to Christ's instruction and they have ceased regular attendance at their meetings. So there's part of that verse in chapter 10, 25, Buckley. I thought I had another part there, but I guess I must have left that out. Timeline. Okay, so what's happening when this book was written? Like we said, we think it's around 65 A.D. So you have the death and resurrection of Christ around 33 A.D. Probably the most famous out of all of the Caesars is Caesar Nero, especially as it pertains to Christians. Caesar Nero is the one, there was the great Roman fire, and he's the one that blamed it on Christians. And that took place around 64 A.D. In fact, in July of 64 A.D. And then the Temple of Jerusalem, 70 A.D. So this gives you an idea of what was happening in the context of the world when this book was written. That might have been, while we're talking about it, this might have also been a ploy to... Probably that people found that Judaism was preferable to Christianity, because this is probably when the start of the Christian persecution seriously took place. There's always been Jewish persecution, but I don't know if it ever, in the Roman context, this led to the death of a lot of Christians, where Jews were often just banished. Or especially out of Rome. This is actually how we believe the church in Corinth started, because all the Jews in Rome were banished and they went to Corinth. And so Paul and Priscilla and Aquila basically started a church there. But this is different because we know that they weren't just banished, that they were killed and tried in kangaroo courts. Key themes, basically. Jesus is fully God and fully man. Something that we talk about quite a bit. Jesus is the Son of God, reveals God the Father, is the agent of creation and sustains all creation. Jesus serves as the eternal high priest, who as a man sympathizes with human weaknesses and yet who offers himself as the perfect sacrifice for sin. All of humanity faces eternal judgment for sin. Faith is necessary to please God and to participate in His eternal salvation promises. Faith requires conviction about the unseen realities of God and His promises. Such faith produces perseverance. Perseverance is necessary in the Christian life, and thus church participants are warned against a lack of endurance. God's promises are trustworthy, including His promises of eternal salvation. With the advent of Christ, the last days have begun, though they await consummation at His return. Any questions on those? Okay, I didn't think so. Literary features. This is what I started talking about earlier. Like I said, it has affinities with both a letter and a sermon. Like I already said, it addresses the superiority of Christ over a number of rivals, and in this case, the rivals are like the Old Testament, the sacrificial system, Moses. Especially that need to follow Christ and not the rivals. This is what I found. I learned this when I was doing this project. Is this book is actually considered to be one of the most stylistic, polished books in the Bible. And by that is, it's very well written. It uses a lot of imagery, metaphors, allusions, comparisons, analogies, contrasts, and long flowing sentences. And it has what's considered to be a powerful climax. So it's considered to be probably whoever wrote this was probably very, very educated. Probably a scholar. And this is why one of the reasons we think Paul didn't write it is because while Paul was very intelligent, Paul was not educated in this way. Paul was educated in the way as a Pharisee. This would have been more of like a historian. So, just interesting thoughts. The book is argumentative. It reads more like a theology textbook than it does like a letter. And if you guys have ever read theology textbooks, you would kind of get the point. It uses classical ways of arguing, certainly not modern day arguing systems. Basically, by that I mean it takes an idea and basically repeats that idea in a multiple, in a lot of different ways. Uses this. When we talked about Philippians, we talked about the word rejoice a lot. This book uses the word more or better or superior a lot. At least a few dozen times. Granted, it's longer, so that's more likely to happen, but you will see this because it fits in part of our central theme. And so then we have the outline of the book. Basically, this is where we see what's going on in the book as it goes on. And you can see how they tie back into our literary themes. Chapter 1, we basically, Jesus is superior to angelic beings. That's chapter 1 to middle of 2. And chapter 3, we get to Jesus is greater than Moses and the Mosaic Law. This continues almost all the way to chapter 10, where we see the call to faith and endurance, and then basically closing marks. Background. Any thoughts and questions on that? That's it. Yes, Joe.
I know I'm asking you to summarize, but could you summarize why the book of Hebrews, without us knowing who the author is, or how the book of Hebrews is placed in the canon, and why it's there? I know you're capable of doing that because you're obviously well studied.
No. Actually, I really don't know why Hebrews in particular. I can tell you how canon is decided. Oh, okay. Actually, I think I can. All right. Canon is decided by a number of things. The Bible has gone through a series of multiple councils to decide canon. And the last one where we have our canon today was basically to fit a few criteria. The first one is that it must have apostolic authorship. Okay, so that means at least that the people who decided the Bible as canon believed that Hebrews was written by an apostolic writer, such as Paul. Since Paul is probably the biggest support, they probably thought or assumed Paul wrote it. It had to contribute. The second thing is it had to contribute something new or something original. This is why the Didache was rejected. The Didache is, while they believe the disciples wrote the Didache, there's really nothing new in the Didache. It's just a repeat of the Gospels. And while there's a lot of similarities between what he talks about in James when he's kind of rebuking the Hebrews for their various problems, this focuses on something that's quite unique, and that is mostly that idea of returning back to the old ways. Let's see, what else? First century, but that not only because of apostolic fathership. And does it say anything contradictory? That's a big one. Such as the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas was written probably in around the time of Origen, like I pointed out to you guys earlier. And there's a lot of contradictions in the Gospel of Thomas, and so it is, even though it claims to have apostolic fathership, it is rejected for being, one, for not being written in the first century, and two, for being contrary to what we know about the Gospels. Those are the biggest ones, and so that would probably describe why Hebrews is in there. As far as I know, I could be wrong on this, so don't quote me. I believe Hebrews has always been accepted as canon. There are some that moved in and out of canon, like the Didache. The Didache was accepted as canon until the last one, until the last council. Second Peter was, I believe, rejected and accepted into canon twice. But I'm pretty sure Hebrews is one of those books that has always met the criteria of canon. This is an interesting phrase. I didn't talk about the word canon. Canon is what we consider to be, what's a great, good way to say this? Basically, what we have today. We consider the 66 books of the Bible to be called canon. Someone who can define that word a little bit better for me. Can you define that word a little bit better? Yeah, okay, the collection.
I know, I went to a class, quite a few years ago, and we had to memorize the first chapter of Hebrews.
Okay.
I don't know if I can remember half of it now, but I won't.
So why did you have to memorize the first chapter of Hebrews? Okay. Do you remember why?
Huh?
Do you remember why?
Remember
why? Do you remember why?
Why?
Did you have to memorize the book or the chapter? Okay. Mark said it was an issue of salvation. Buckley, I think I saw your hand up. No, I kind of thumbed through it a while ago, but I haven't. I'm not really talking about what's in it. I just wanted to say why it's typically rejected.
Well, it's interesting because some of the churches did accept it as canon at one time.
Well, I'm sure that's true. I mean, for example, there's always been some controversy of whether or not Jude should be accepted because of its mention of Enoch, the book of Enoch, which especially it's quoting, I believe it's quoting like 3rd or 4th Enoch. And while most scholars accept that 1st and 2nd Enoch is what's called Apocrypha, it just means the writings, they reject 3rd and 4th as pseudopocrypha, which is false writings. And so Jude, who's quoting what's commonly accepted as a false writing, has always been somewhat of a mystery. I don't think it really changes his meaning, which is why it's been accepted. But people use a lot of people use a lot of garbage. I'm not saying anyone here does that, but I'm just saying it's very common. Anyone else? Don't really want to move into this section yet. We've only got a few more minutes. Go ahead, Jim.
I cannot remember all the details of this, but we're not when King James authorized the translation of the King James Version and their committee put all this together, were all the books that were in the King James Version or the King James canon that they put together, was it all like what we have here, or were there any extra books?
honestly don't know. Yeah. You said you were Catholic. I believe the Catholics include the Apocrypha in their Bible, right? Yeah. Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if if there was the Apocrypha in the King James, the 1611 King James Bible had the original Apocrypha. But I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't either. I'm going to guess it doesn't because I know a lot of people who like the King James and use
it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I have a lot of problems with the King James in general. The New King James isn't as bad, but the Old King James, they use a lot of that. They kind of downplay because of the monarchy, they downplay the reign of Christ. And so a lot of things get changed in that. I don't think that the New King James has that problem, though. I prefer... I know a lot of you probably are using different Bibles, and this actually would be a good place to talk about this for a second. I'm using the ESV Bible. Is anybody here using the ESV? Anyone? Yeah, extra special version for an extra special person. Is anyone here using NIV? What about King James or New King James? Okay. American Standard? Okay, New American Standard. Is anybody else using something else? New American Standard? Okay. Alright. There's a reason we have so many different Bible translations. The first thing is just because of the way Greek is written. As my Greek teacher used to tell me, forget the place. The place doesn't matter. In English, every word in a sentence has to be in a very particular spot for the sentence to make sense. In Greek, it doesn't. In Greek, the spelling of the words changed based on the part of speech that is used. So, if you use your name as a subject, you would spell your name differently as a direct object.
Yeti?
Yo, Gideon. Oh, I forgot about the Gideon. That's probably the most... Did you get it from a hotel? So that makes, because of that, sometimes the way a sentence is structured can be structured, well, not sometimes, actually quite often, you can translate a sentence with a slightly different meaning. Well, it doesn't, not a slightly different meaning, but a slightly different phrase. I think that's the best way to put it. And so the question is, do you go for accuracy or do you go for understanding? Because if you did a literal translation, it probably wouldn't make, it would probably sound wrong and terrible to you. And so also because there's, we don't use words the same way they use words. We have a lot more synonyms than they do. Languages evolve. Even modern Greek is very, very different than it is from Koine Greek. Or even if you, has anybody ever read Chaucer? Geoffrey Chaucer? Canterbury Tales? That's written in Middle English. Try reading that sometime. It's very difficult. You had a question, Mark. Oh, I thought you were going to say something. Yeah. It is a terrible choice. Because that's why there are so many different translations. I think for accuracy, the New American Standard is actually considered to be the most accurate English translation. Next to that is probably the ESV. Understanding, NIV is considered to be the most widely used for understanding, where you still have some accuracy, where you're not moving on to paraphrasing. I suggest as long as you avoid paraphrase Bibles, you're probably okay. Willie?
I think maybe to help understand what John Paul is saying, choosing between accuracy and understanding, he was talking about the word order. In English, we would say, Tom saw a dog. But in Greek, they might say, a dog was seen by Tom. And so if we just translate it word for word, it wouldn't make
that. Well, it even becomes more difficult than that, because it could say a dog saw Tom. But that would be accurate if you translated it as it word for word. But because of, like I said, the way that the place doesn't really matter in sentence structure, this actually, the biggest place I know where this creates a confusion is John 1:1, because there's no the way it's worded, God is the same as a direct object as it is as a subject, and so it makes sense to say the Word was God, but Mormons say God was the Word. Yes.
A highly technical term for, taking like the ASV and the New American Standard Version or the original language, the highly technical term of making that reasonable, the highly technical term is called smoothing out.
Oh, that is highly technical. All right. So, this was a very interesting discussion. How did I get this? Oh, I didn't even realize he gave it to me. Thank you. We will start in verse 1, chapter 1 next week. And I hope you found this interesting. This is the kind of stuff I love to talk about, because we don't ever talk about this stuff. Mm-hmm. All right, let's close in prayer. Dear Most Heavenly Father, thank you for this.